Amy is an only child who has a cartoon as a twin, and this, and all of a sudden it made sense why I couldn't quite grasp her.
It's like facts filling out your instincts.
Yeah, exactly. You go, I don't know, something's off here, something's different, something's special, and what is it? And then all of a sudden I realized.
What are we saying about marriage?
Gil, over to you. He's looking at guilt. You know, I certainly started the story with that idea of, you know, how honest are we ever in relationships? You know, I like that idea that we are kind of emotional con artists when we start in on, on any sort of meeting, that we're presenting our best self forward. And I like that idea that, you know, this was, a murder mystery, but marriage was the mystery. You know, to solve the murder, you have to solve the marriage and figure out who these two people really were. And that idea, you know, especially in this very media saturated world, you know, how much are we ever really our true selves at all? And that's why I like the idea of the media is almost the third character in this film.
Yeah, and this also pervades this idea of what are they thinking?
Yeah, exactly. Do you ever really know what the person's thinking? You know, just because they tell you what they're thinking, are they truth telling there?
This is a book that we all know the ending from reading the book. Does that bother you at all? I mean,
we all do.
Everybody's read the book, no?
Well, yes, exactly. Yeah.
But you have to create a mystery.
I mean, I think the reason movie studios buy hit books is because it's in this arena.
There's a title, first of all.
Yeah, but in this arena, it means more than 2-3 million people handed it to somebody and said, "You got to read this." So it has been wind tunnel tested in a way.
That this is a story that works.
Yeah.
But also we've made this film painstakingly over a long period of time, and it's not just about knowing what happened. I think there's so much more in it.
All that stuff is like, was it T.S. Eliot, I think, said that the, if you think of a playwright as trying to break into the mind of the audience, that the plot is basically just the sort of meat you throw the guard dogs to distract them while you get into the subconscious, and that's really what's going on here. You know, this plot, it's not that it's discarded, but that it occupies the conscious mind of the front brain. Well, underneath, this very provocative question is asked, which is, how much of marriage is lying? Which I think is sort of scary. I mean, everyone, you know, wants to think they have a good marriage and doesn't want to think of themselves as a liar, but by the same token, there's a sort of dance of how do I present myself and the question of at what point do I...
And so how quick do we find out in marriage that there's an element of lying?
I think it depends on your marriage.
Depends,
I think,
how long, you know, people are willing to play the game, because, you know, Gillian sets this couple up. Gillian sets up this couple who, sort of, for narcissistic reasons of their own, have slightly shifted their true selves to sort of slot in with who they'd like to be perceived to be by the other person.
The suggestion is that any couple could be this couple, that it could go this way, and that these tendencies are at the root of marriage, along with all of the love and the purity and that stuff. There's also this underbelly that could be potentially quite toxic.
Let me go back to casting, because there's so many interesting people here. How did you approach that? Did each of them, like Tyler Perry?
I had met Tyler in real life, and I just...
Plays a classic defense attorney.
Well, but in the book, I mean, he's much more of, you know, he's...
Showman.
He's a little more...
Razzle-dazzle.
He's also a little more cynical. You know, I think in the book, he's much more of a, he's kind of a huckster. And what I love, as we were starting to sort of see the faces and have the pictures and kind of get a look at the team, you know, one of the things that I sort of felt was we'd have so little screen time with Tanner. Maybe he shouldn't be this guy who's totally smooth. Maybe he should be a guy who's totally honest and puts you at ease. And when you talk to Tanner Bolt, who is introduced as this shyster, you know, like, you know, and you see him and he's like, you got to go take it on the chin. You got to walk out there and you got to take your lumps. And this is the best way to do it. Show contrition. And that's what is, and what I love is his voice and his manner. And as an actor, he watches everything so, you know, he's so wrapped in it. He watches everybody. And I thought that was something.
The nature of Tyler Perry.
Yeah, he's just, you know, it is that.
It's a student always.
Yeah, he's the talk show host. He's like somebody who's going to sit you down and make you feel calm, and you're going to spill.
What is it tell us about, in the end, about media and how we, those of us who don't, I don't do a lot of that, but we all are obsessed by celebrity. And in fact, we bring a prism to it that's unreal.
Well, it's not, it's, it, we're not talking about the media. We're talking about a very narrow spectrum, which is tragedy vampirism. Right. And that's a,
it's tragedy a,
vampirism.
Vampirism.
Yeah.
Is that a term you coined?
I've trademarked it, but no, I don't know any other way to describe it.
Grief jacking.
Yeah, exactly. Grief jacking. I like that better. Trademark that. It's when you see these programs that are designed to stoke your righteous indignation about what is such an obvious, you know, when it's 9 times out of 10 that it's the husband, and it's so obvious this is one of those 9 times, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about that rush to judgment. We're talking about the stoking of the lynch mob.
There's certain profiteering that I think is unseemly, where and an inserting of oneself into a story, and when it doesn't seem to be, you know, scandalous or prurient enough, you know, trying to dig around for more details. It's like, look, clearly someone murdered someone in their family. I mean, you know, it's appropriate to report on it. It's appropriate to, but then there come these like huckster lawyers who show up and want to sue somebody, and 4 more, you know, shows show up, and I think there's this sort of chicken and the egg thing where the people who are doing this, you know, semi-hysterical reportage around murder say, well, it's what the you know, we're giving people what they want. This is the demand is there for it, so we give them. But I think that's a sort of sophistry, not unlike, you know, what a crack dealer might say to you. Where you go, well, why are you doing this? Go, well, people want the crack. Well, they weren't all smoking it to begin with because you sold it to them.
Talk to somebody in Mexico. Why do you sell so many drugs? Because you Americans want them.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what they say.
Because there's a market.
Yeah. There's a market. You wrote characters, two important characters, Nick and Amy. Was it easier for you to write one or the other? And part of that's a gender question, but Nick may be more interesting.
It was easier for me to write Nick. I mean, I'm Nick-like. There's a certain, you know, Nick I gave, you know, Nick has a lot of my biography. Yeah, we come from the same area. We, you know, both were
journalist,
pop culture obsessed, and wrote about that, and you know, I certainly feel I have a very soft spot for everything that Nick gets himself into, because I'm sort of that sort of same way. Like, what's the easiest thing to do here is to well, you know, I'll smile and see where this goes instead of actually fighting it, which I think is a lot of Nick's thing. And with, you know, with Amy, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out who Amy was. You know, I spent a lot of doing, you know, old fashioned like college level, you know, exercises, writing exercises to try to figure out who Amy was. It took a little bit longer than that to, you know, that's why Amy has got such an elaborate backstory. You know, the parents weren't in there to begin with, but as I was trying to figure out who she was, I was like, it's got to go back to the childhood somewhere.
And what's the impact on her of the fact that, I mean, she hates it when she gets to a small town, or realizes she hates it, but what's the impact on her in terms of the development that she has this cartoon character sister?
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's kind of what I thought when I was realizing where I knew that I knew she came from money early on. I couldn't figure out what the family industry was for a while. It was like a dating site, and I thought that, you know, that was too on the nose. It was kind of like this eHarmony marriage site, and then I thought, yeah, oh,
actually, we should have done that. But whatever, keep going.
The DVD
Stop
extra fulfillment. You know, and then I just realized that idea of, first of all, this kind of unearned honor. You know, her parents are the one that created this famous alter ego for her. Right. She didn't do it. But at the same time, I like the idea that it was always a little bit better than she was. So she was, you know, in constant, you know, sibling rivalry with this thing that didn't really exist. But, I mean, Rosamund, how did you get in? Did that feel right to you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you talked about celebrity earlier or whatever, I think that's the hardest thing, is when you're under the media spotlight for something you didn't earn through your own merits. Yeah. Which is what Amy's had from a tiny little girl. She's had to perform at these book functions.
So does she feel like a fake, or?
I think she doesn't know who she is. I think she's got a fragile sense of self, because you've got this amazing Amy character who, you know, excels everywhere, at every point that the real Amy failed or gave up, you know, whether it's sport or music or academia or whatever. And yet she's meant to sort of go out there and parade herself as a sort of, you know, as the prototype.
Yeah.
And I think it's meant her, maybe she's probably very sort of inward looking because of that, and also a sense of sort of entitlement coupled with inferiority or inadequacy, which makes a very unstable person. So you translate that little girl into an adult woman who's in New York on the dating scene, where there's freedom, as you say, in New York, to sort of keep reinventing yourself, perhaps not so if you do live in a small town, because your circle of friends can just shift. And she'll just be whoever she needs to be to get the best out of that situation, you know.
Let's talk about Mr. Fincher as a director.
Oh, jeez.
Is he different?
We don't talk about this much, but he...
Are you putting me on? This is awkward.
The studio felt as though they needed... I don't want to say ghost director, but...
Are you putting me on?
Somebody who could...
Like
this a grown-up on the set.
That's fair.
And so, because they, you know, it's not that he's bad, Charlie. Yeah, that's not what I'm saying.
I got it.
Or helpless, or confused. Those are the wrong words.
But he needed somebody there when he had to make the hard decision.
A decision maker.
Exactly.
Not a ghost director, but so, yeah. You know, the so, smile okay, also just, made a lot of that decisions.
Let me see if I've got it now. On the set, he kind of is wishy-washy. He doesn't really know what he wants. Pretty much is willing to take the first thing he sees exactly and go with it. Have I got it?
Yeah. Good enough.
The guy.
Good enough.
Doesn't care much, and so obviously David's got the whole. You know, everybody knows that David is. I think you just make it work anyway. Like a lot of the behind the scenes anecdotes, I've seen like good directors and bad directors. It's hard to tell sometimes when you watch them work because stylistically people are different. But David's movies are, speak for themselves, and they're excellent and they're great. And so that's the thing. As an actor, you show up and say like, I want to work with somebody who I can trust, because so often you lay yourself out there just as hard for a movie that works as one that doesn't. You know, like I was saying about what Roz did, for just the physical aspect of getting banged against walls and thrown on the ground. David has yet to learn about stunt actors, actually. That's
Wait, that either. Wait. It's a punishment to be with him.
No, it's that you put yourself out, you commit yourself, and you want it to be like, you want someone to use the good stuff. You want someone to appreciate what you want. Someone smart to make a smart movie, and that's at its basis the appeal. And I liked when I first sat down with David, he was like, I thought it was going to be Club Med or what or something, but he was like, look, it's not about the process for me. It's about, like, I want to do something. It's about the products, it's about what we do ultimately, how we express this. In other words, the message is not going to be, we're not going to be a party, we're not going to have fun, we're not doing this so we can, get free drinks after or something. You know what I mean? This is about making something that we can be proud of, and I like that idea a lot, a lot more than just sort of like, we'll get a good caterer and that kind of stuff.
This is what he said about his famous takes. It's a lot of extra work for an actor, and sometimes it pushes them out of their comfort area in a zone. In some cases, they're not getting paid as much as they would on another movie. I go out on a limb, and people work harder for me than they do for other people, but I want them to be happy with the fact that we were able to do something singular, something unlike anything else in their or my filmography. That's well said.
It's very well said.
You know, that's what you were saying. That's exactly what you were saying.
David just wrote that, and it's true. It's exactly right. I did some edits, but it's very,
you did this
very well done. I did.
So not only did he want you to be a kind of assistant director, but a publicist for him.
Publicist, Charlie. That's how it works.
Executive director. The sandwich.
No, it's true. It's like, are we going to, like, you get to a certain point, you know, what matters is, is this going to matter to me? Am I going to be proud of this? And David is to... praise him in front of him is awkward, but he's there before anybody, and he's there after everyone's gone home. And I think that's a mark of a guy who's saying, look, we can succeed and we can fail. We can make good choices or bad choices, but I'm going to be as invested, if not more so, than anybody here. And that's actually not common among guys who have become really successful and kind of been around the block. And some directors tend to kind of go like, you know, yeah, I can prep the movie in 2 weeks. Yeah. And yeah, you know, I feel like this is pretty good. And David has, more drive than a hungry director. Never mind a guy who's like fat on the hog in Santa Barbara. You know?
That's he's fat on the hog in Santa Barbara?
Then the guys who are fat. He's fat on the hog in Los Feliz.
Yeah. Okay, well.
It's just about time. I mean, in any skilled or creative endeavor, the more time you're given, the better results you're going to get, generally. Yeah. And you know, David will spend his budget mainly on time, not on sort of, huge crew that's going to sort of, I mean, that's where the money on screen. We'd shoot maybe 5 hours of footage a day. That's a lot of time on camera, especially you know, which is a luxury. I mean, the easiest way to make an actor screw something up is to say, we've got to get this in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And then they're going to bring all their it's going to hit the fan and the
thing. But it is indicative of a priority. It's a zero-sum game. You have a certain amount of money and time. How do you spend that? And in this movie, anyway, and I think in David's other movies, it's spent in front of the camera shooting. And for an actor, you have two options. You can be making the movie, doing what's interesting, trying different things, or you can be sitting in your trailer, which is incredibly boring and frustrating because you're not there
you
to do what you want to do.
And
with him, by far, the ratio of time shooting to bullshitting is higher than I've ever seen, and it's really rewarding. And the day goes by to 14 hours, you're like, or 12 hours or whatever, and it feels like nothing.
Do you try to pick actors who you know have that philosophy that you have? I mean, do you somehow know that that's kind of
I think it's your job to sort of inspire people to well, I think, look, I agree. I think actors want to act. I don't think they want to spend time, you know, on Twitter. I think that they want to, like, actually show up and do and have bites at the apple.
Yeah.
You know, I have a lot of friends who are actors who do live theater, and I go to visit them, and I go backstage to see them, and they say, oh, God, you should have come on Tuesday. That was the one. And you go, what? You don't want to do that with a movie. You know, with a movie, you want to go,
you want to debate
yeah, here it is on Blu-ray. Yeah. And by the way, this is all the best stuff. This is just literally, there's actually some good stuff that isn't in here, but this is the best.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm trying
to
do.
All the questions that honestly come with all these interviews about how many takes, it just makes me think, you know, the far more interesting questions to people who don't do multiple takes is why do you only do two or three?
Why did you know you could make it better?
You know,
why gather all these people all this money and the trucks and the drivers and the sets and the thing and then go like, look, that seemed good enough. I don't know. You guys want a head? You know, pretty good.
Let's go to the casino.
Yeah, exactly.
Where are Nick and Amy in 10 years?
Nowhere good. Nowhere good. You know, I love the people have asked me, you know, when's the sequel coming? You know, I certainly did not set out to write anything that was going to go on. You know, I ended the book the way I ended it, though, because I like those open-ended. I like that sense of kind of unease that you have. And
you didn't want it neatly tied together.
I didn't want it neatly tied together. Absolutely not. And, you know, certainly I knew that was not always going to be the most satisfying ending for some people, especially for people who have been kind of trained that, you know, and here comes the movie and here's the explosion or the gunshot
here's the
or
justice.
What. Yeah, here
the
comes
justice.
The justice.
Here's the rabbit.
Yeah.
Could you find the justice in this?
Yeah. Well, I mean, people tell me all the time that people will wait 30 minutes in line to get their book signed by me and slam it down in front of me and say, I hated the ending. Yeah. And I say, you know, well, what did you want to happen? I wanted justice. I said, what about this story ever made you believe there was going to be justice?
Yeah. What about these characters?
What about life?
Yeah, that's right.
Exactly.
What about love?
What about love? Where does justice...
There's no justice in love.
I don't think so.
So when you think about 5 to 10 years, are you now intrigued by the idea of coming back to these characters?
Certainly not for a while. I've had a fair amount of Nick and Amy, but, you know, I've been in their brains for too long.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'd like to see, you know, if the when the teen years come around, what the...
You're intrigued by this, aren't you?
I think what's interesting about that question is that the paradigm shift would be, not that this is like saying you should be a sequel or whatever, but just the idea of it is that the whole thing changes because there would be a child. You'd have a kid. They'd be raised with a kid.
Exactly.
And so the center of gravity is not Nick or Amy or Nick and Amy or their whole, shtick together. It's like, how are they affecting the life of this child? It's a big reason why Nick ends up, or why he says he ends up staying. It's like, now my responsibility is to this child, and my own needs have to be completely subverted. And I often admire people, actually, who I know who have made choices like that, who said, like, this is a... It's a consequence of some choices I made in love, but now here I am, this child's here, and I'm going to invest in it at the expense of a lot of other stuff I'd rather be doing. And that's half of what Nick says. And I think that's interesting and much more tragic than a bad marriage is the, like, horrible baggage, you know, that can be passed on to children.
To children.
Well, and as everyone knows, you know, who to do the whole classic have the baby to save the marriage thing, the children only expose any cracks and fissures that are already there. So I think, you know, seeing what that brings out in Nick and Amy as they each try to mold or protect the child could be sort of fascinating.
You're intrigued by what happens to Amy?
As a mother, yeah. I am intrigued. Yes, I mean, your brain continues with the characters long after you finish shooting the movie, so... But I need to have Gillian's brain to really figure it out.
What was the hardest thing about Nick for you?
The hardest thing was definitely, like, when I first sat down with David, he just said, you know, look, this is, we have to just let go of any vanity, any of the actory stuff, any pretense to, you know, self-consciousness and worrying about what people will think. And there's parts of...
Meaning being a mean character?
Doing things that people judge. Like, you can read things and go, well, this guy, Nick, he's a jerk. Like, a lot of journalists say that. And you have to understand, I've done enough movies to know, and I have enough friends who are actors to know, that audiences conflate people with the characters they play. So there's a vulnerability there to go, like, you know, I know people who are not great people, but who are thought of as great people because they play great characters and vice versa.
Yes, right,
and I've been in situations where people have sort of made judgments about me based on the characters that I played. And so there's a raw kind of first level of soil that says, like, oh, we're going to do that, I'm going to do that, but that looks like horrible, you know?
Well, it's not even the notion of did he or didn't he, and has he done something evil. It's also, he does things that are very human that are like, oh, why?
Right.
And that's a really, it's a hard thing. Audiences go out of their way, and I think actors go out of their way, you know, to be in a situation where you can avoid that. You've agreed on what the text is. You've rehearsed the thing. You've taken, you know, hopefully the stumble and fall out of the equation. This is a character who, you know, steps on a rake and gets hit in the forehead.
Yeah.
I mean, he continually does that.
But did your idea, Nick, believe that he could come back in terms of recapturing the life that he had?
I think this was a guy who was sort of felt like he was operating from behind the whole time. You know, he reminded me of, you know, those rats that you see in glass cages who keep on scrabbling, think they can get up, but you know what I mean? But they're just sitting there going like this. And there was a lot
that,
of that.
That was your idea of that, Nick.
Part of it. And he kept on doing things wrong and spending time going, how am I going to fix the last thing that happened?
Yeah.
And making that stuff feel like, because I think that's us. We're constantly shooting ourselves in the foot in ways that we try to pretend we don't, which when we present our best selves and we say our lines right and don't step on the furniture. And I wanted to... you know, I believe that he was a guy who was kind of playing catch up, and it took the support of his sister and this sort of wonderfully, like, sort of magically almost deus ex machina,
yeah,
Tyler Perry to come down and say, like, you've made many mistakes. And now we're going to try to salvage what we can.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes in life we need someone to go, and then he feels like, okay, I can do this. And he starts to take control of his life. And what I think is interesting is that he does have these kind of Midwestern values that she talks about, of like good manners and earnestness and friendliness and honesty. And every one of those gets him in trouble. And he doesn't become successful until he abandons all that stuff and starts to be like, okay, I'll become manipulative. And, you know, like cagey and slightly disingenuous in terms of how I, you know, plan how I come off in the media and that stuff. I kind of thought that was a bold...
And he's good at it when he does it. He's good at it. You know, towards the last section of the movie, we move into this very, very surreal place where we're sort of... we're satirizing so much, and yet it's sort of... it's the point that you feel a palpable shift in the audience as they start to kind of see these two players playing each other in a totally different way. And I just love the idea that Amy has kind of, for her purposes, has reignited the Nick that she first saw.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he is now performing. He is now, you know, reflecting. He is now, in her narcissistic mind, sort of worthy of her because he's not, you know, the schlub in his boxes playing video games. He's back to presenting a public facade, to performing, to playing the... husband's incredible.
You know, I've never been part of a movie, I can't even think of a movie really, that has genuinely changed tones during the course of the movie.
Yeah.
The beginning, it's very realistic, matter of fact, wife's blood type, interrogated by the police, and you look at me, and in the end, she's holding me sort of hostage by, you know, in the shower, and there's blood, and the whole thing is like, she's killed. I mean, the whole thing has mushroomed into something totally different that to me is sort of segued from realism into using a kind of broader brush to allow these themes to emerge in a really rich way. And I don't, it's done, it's why I never thought it'd be possible to make this movie. I had no idea how you would do it. And it's a really interesting trick that David and Gillian pulled off.
Thank you. It's incredible. It really is. Thank you, David. Thank you. Remarkable. Thank you.
Starting business with Startup New York, an unprecedented program that partners businesses with universities across the state for better access to talent, cutting-edge research, and state-of-the-art facilities. And you pay no taxes for 10 years. From biotech in Brooklyn to next-gen energy in Binghamton to manufacturing in Buffalo, Startup New York has new businesses popping up across the state. See how Startup New York can help your business grow at startup.ny.gov.
This is the cat that drank the milk and let in the dog that woke the man who drove to the control room.
Driver was mode engaged.
Find parking space.
Parking space found.
That secured the data that directed the turbines that powered the farm, that made the milk that went to the store, that reminded the man to buy the milk that was poured by the girl who loved the cat. The Internet of Everything is changing everything. Cisco, tomorrow starts here.
Go ahead and put your bag right here. Have a nice flight.
Traveling can feel like one big mystery. You're never quite sure what is coming your way. But when you've got an entire company who knows that the most on-time flights are nothing if we can't get your things there, too. It's no wonder more people choose Delta than any other airline.
How do you start your day so you make better investment decisions?
You watch Bloomberg Surveillance to find out what the markets are doing. And you talk to smart people. Bloomberg Surveillance, weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Television.
I'm only in my 60s. I've got a nice long life ahead. Big plans. So when I found out Medicare doesn't pay all my medical expenses, I got a Medicare supplement insurance plan.
If you're eligible for Medicare, you may know it only covers about 80% of your Part B medical expenses. The rest is up to you. Call now and find out about an AARP Medicare supplement insurance plan insured by United Healthcare Insurance Company. Like all standardized Medicare supplement insurance plans, it could save you in out-of-pocket medical costs. Call now to request your free decision guide.
I've been with my doctor for 12 years. Now I know I'll be able to stick with them.
You'll be able to visit any doctor or hospital that accepts Medicare patients. Plus, there are no networks and virtually no referrals needed. See why millions of people have already enrolled in the only Medicare supplement insurance plans endorsed by AARP. Don't wait. Call now.
Ours was the first modern airliner, revolutionary by every standard. And that became our passion, to always build something better. Airplanes that fly cleaner and farther on less fuel, that redefine comfort and connect the world like never before. After all, you can't turn dreams into airplanes unless your passion for innovation is nonstop.
Partnerships occur when both share a passion for improving, for growing in harmony. Speak from the heart and respect the other. Feeling of being comfortable, of being open that creates the true partnership, which ensures the greatest success. Together, invest in remarkable Indonesia.
I'm John Heilman.
And I'm Mark Halpern. And with all due respect, we're doing this entire episode without any pine tar.
Bienvenido, sports fans, in our lineup tonight. Michelle Obama is on the air. The Senate is up for grabs. And Bill Clinton is hungry for some bacon. But first, or as Jeb Bush might put it, pero primero, the race for the White House. As we predicted, the de facto candidates for 2016 are on the stump, but also on the small screen. One of them is speaking Spanish, one is hitting an easier target than Shia LaBeouf, and the other is preaching to the converted.
Como ustedes, yo también quiero soluciones para nuestros grandes problemas. Y es por eso que es vital elegir a líderes como Cory Gardner.
The IRS tells you to hang on to 7 years of your personal tax information, but they can't even keep 6 months of employee emails. Make it easier on hardworking taxpayers, less of the IRS, and more people working. I'm Paul Ryan, and I may get audited for approving this message, but it would be worth it.
Washington is horribly broken. I'm Rand Paul, and I'm fighting to change that. Washington takes too much of our freedoms and too much of our money. I think Dan Sullivan will get it back.
Mark, there are a lot of qualities that a presidential candidate needs to have, and one of them is being good on television, and one particular one is being good in television ads. What do you make of those ads and what it says about those three guys?
Now, Jeb Bush and Rand Paul on behalf of other people in Chamber of Commerce ads and Paul Ryan for himself, I think all three of them really good in those ads. Paul Ryan, I think probably the weakest of the three. First of all, we got to say Jeb Bush's Spanish.
Oh, my God.
Awesome.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Yes. So good it almost seemed like it was overdubbed,
I know,
but with an actual native Spanish speaker.
But I mean, I don't mean to disrespect President Bush 43, but this guy's Spanish, better.
Much better.
Paul Ryan was fine. The Rand thing in Alaska, you go on BloombergPolitics.com and watch the whole 30-second spot. It's kind of intense. And
it is.
And that's his performance. But I think all three of them are strong, and they're all out there trying to make their mark. And one way to do it is on the stump and fundraising, but another is with ads like that. And I think all of them are pretty good.
Yeah, and they are, as you just mentioned, fundraising. A number of those guys, a number of other guys were in New York City yesterday for a big fundraiser at Woody Johnson's house. You have a story up that you're working on about that. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
A story coming a little bit later tonight on BloombergPolitics.com about this event last night that Woody Johnson hosted. Right. Mitt Romney was there.
Yeah.
After he did the show, he went over there. But you had a bunch of candidates, Christie, John Kasich, potential candidates. And my sense from talking to people who were at the event was no one really wowed the crowd. They all left thinking, we raised $2 million for the RNC. But no one left there thinking, wow, I found my candidate tonight. Now, Jeb Bush wasn't there, and he's the favorite of a lot of those guys from around the country. But it was an interesting event. Rupert Murdoch was there, and he and Mitt Romney had a little private huddle at one point during the evening. People are wondering what they talked about.
Yeah, I heard Rand Paul had another event the same night, went over and saw a bunch of tech executives and CEOs where his libertarian message goes down pretty well. He did better at that event than he did at the Woody thing.
All right, moving on to the election that's actually happening right now, 2014, not 2016. That's the midterm, specifically the key Senate races. There are debates tonight in the Colorado, Georgia, and North Carolina races. John, we're going to use this opportunity to take a look at where the race stands, the battle for the Senate, and of course that is, as Jeb Bush would say, the big enchilada. So the way we look at it now, as everybody knows, Republicans need to net six, and they've got three in the bag, so they're looking for three more. You see those states on the right there, Alaska, Colorado, Iowa, Arkansas, Louisiana, North Carolina. We call them the big six. We
above the line.
All the way above the line. Then New Hampshire and Michigan. Some Republicans today or some Democrats today were seizing on media reports saying Republicans have given up in Michigan. We're told no. In fact, they like their ground game there. They like the governor's race. And that's still in place. So from those eight, they need to net three, unless, of course, they start losing some of the Republican-held ones. Talk about that.
There's three ones down there, right there, Kansas, Kentucky, and Georgia. All of those races, amazingly, are races that a few weeks ago you would have thought Republicans would be in fine shape. Not now.
So tell me what you see the scenario is. If Republicans are going to take this, what you think the most likely scenario is?
All right, so the likeliest scenario, it seems to me, if you go in order of where the Democrats are in jeopardy, Louisiana seems to me to be the place where it's most likely gone for the Democrats. Arkansas, also really tough. Alaska. So that if they won those three, Republicans won those three races, that would give them their net three. However, now we come back to those red states. Kansas
Kansas right now, according to the most recent polling, Pat Roberts is back by double digits. And if a lot of Republicans are in panic over that. So if they lose that race, they're then now shy one. And to me, if you look at this whole map, the one that is the tightest race in the country right now and the one where Republicans have a chance is Iowa. And that could be the one where the race comes down. That could be the one that means control or not control for them on election. You
know, I mean, look, I don't think any of these are a done deal. And very few Republicans would say they are. But Arkansas, Louisiana are the two that I think are most likely. Then I think
for Republicans to pick up.
That's right. I don't have a strong feeling about Alaska because Democrats' ground game there is supposed to be so strong. Yeah. They've got to remake the electorate there as much as any place else out of a normal midterm electorate. And then you get to Iowa. I still think Joni Ernst is going to be hard for her to lose with Branstad, Governor Branstad, running at the top of the ticket so strong. So if they can pick up those four, that could offset if they lose one of these three. The most interesting thing.
Possibly they could lose two.
That's the most interesting thing to me right now is I have good Republican sources who say, you talked about Kansas, that's the toughest one for them.
Right.
They've got to
sure.
eliminate Orman or they're going to lose that.
Georgia's the wild card.
Georgia, but also even Kentucky. There's some public polling saying that's close. There's not a single one of these where I can't find a credible Republican who says, you know, we might lose it.
Yeah.
In all of them, there's a Republican saying we could lose it. Georgia is the most interesting to me because that's going to be a coalition, unlike the Democrats have put together in a long time in that state. Big African-American voter registration, big turnout. And again, just to simplify, the more of these three that Democrats can take away, the harder it is for Republicans to get
and very tricky in six. Very tricky in Georgia because of the president's role. He could really drive up African-American turnout, but he could really be a bad thing in terms of undecided voters there. So the party's got to make a kind of devilish choice on that. Michelle Obama was in two states today. Right now she's in Illinois campaigning for Pat Quinn, for whom she's just cut this new ad.
This is Michelle Obama, and I know Pat Quinn. I've seen that Pat has the courage to do what's right. So for this election, Barack and I are casting our votes for our friend, Pat Quinn.
It's kind of an awesome ad. She's, you know, incredibly telegenic. Earlier today, she was in Wisconsin, where a CBS affiliate shot this clip that we're about to see. Part of it's off camera, but listen to the line she says about needing the Obama coalition to turn up to vote if Democrats are going to do well in the midterms.
If women and minorities and young people show up, Mary wins. She wins. If we each find our 10, Mary wins. She wins. If we're more organized, if we're more passionate, Mary wins.
So this is the thing that Michelle Obama is great at doing. She riles up the base and gets them excited and enthused. But there's been some reporting that, you know, she's not doing, her husband's doing very little campaigning. She's not doing as much as some people thought. Why is that?
Well, you know, I think she's always wanted to stay home and take care of her daughters, and I think she still looks for candidates who she really feels invested in. The Wisconsin race is one where they do feel invested. It was still up in the air just how much she's going to do. What I loved at the top of that bite, an explicit reference to the coalition they sent it, women, yep. minorities, young people. Look, in all these states, they need women and young people to turn out. Minorities means different things, different places. In a state like Wisconsin, they need African Americans to turn out. Obviously, in Colorado, they need Hispanics to turn out, African Americans in some those southern races. In Alaska, they need Native Alaskans to turn out. So it's an explicit pitch, and I think she'll be doing more of that. And look, it's still the case. Yeah. She can't go. President Obama can't go everywhere the Clintons can go. She can still go more places than President Obama right now.
She is more popular than he is by far, and she has been for a long time. But it's interesting the number of people you hear who say he is so unpopular now with undecided voters that her just having the same name as him doesn't overcome her high Q ratings, and so people are hesitant to have her in.
Right. All right. A little news for you late this afternoon. A federal appeals court in California struck down bans on same-sex marriage in Idaho and Nevada one day after the Supreme Court handed gay rights advocates another victory by deciding not to take up the issue this term. There'll be more on that. There is more on that on BloombergPolitics.com. All right. One rule we have around here is you can never have too much Arkansas barbecue. Another rule, you can never have too much Bill Clinton.
Never.
Here is an awesome piece of video from today. President Clinton doing a classic Arkansas hog call at a rally in Fayetteville for the Democratic ticket.
We've got the former president here, and we have a bunch of national press. What do you say we call the hogs?
If we someday have to change the name of this show from, with all due respect, I want to call it, what do you say we call the hogs? That'd be a good alternate
title. Totally fantastic. The only thing that Bill Clinton does not seem totally authentic on is on that, just because of the fact that, as we know, he's more or less a vegan now, so the idea of him trying to summon the pigs to come doesn't seem totally natural to me.
The first time I was in Arkansas and I heard them do that suey thing, it kind of...
Freaked you out?
It confused me. Yeah. Now, couldn't be more natural. Yeah. Arkansas... Calling the pigs.
Totally incredible. Yeah. All right. Once again, the most exciting races in the country are happening as we speak on the Field of Dreams. Last night, Beltway baseball fans heaved a sigh of relief as the Washington Nationals staved off elimination by beating my San Francisco Giants. The potheads and the bureaucrats will play again later tonight. Who you got in that game, Mark?
Man, I'm sort of cheering for the Nationals because I like the Nationals. I don't much like your Giants, and I would love there to be a five-game cliffhanging final thing Thursday in the nation's capital. That'd be kind of awesome.
It would be exciting. I do not want to lose the bet that I made with Al Hunt, which would involve me having to wear a national sweatshirt on this show for like a month and a half. So I'm still sticking with my Giants in that rooting heart.
Yeah, and Kansas City, Baltimore, when does that start?
I believe that starts on Thursday. Fonzie, do you know the answer to that question? I think it's Thursday.
We'll look it up and we'll bring it to you soon. All right, coming up, our very own personal White House briefing, Josh Earnest, White House press secretary and all-around good man.
And handsome.
Is here next.
Handsome.
Bloomberg's With All Due Respect is brought to you by Koch Industries. Learn more at KochCareers.com.
Koch Industries started in the heartland, and we've expanded to nearly every state. Today, that's more than 60,000 American jobs. You may not always see our name on the products you use, but we help make better food, clothing, shelter, technologies, and other necessities. Here, we build on each other's ideas to create more opportunities for people everywhere. Together, we are Coke.
Try the new Bloomberg Business Week Plus app for Samsung phone and tablet and get your first year of Bloomberg Business Week free. You'll get deeper intelligence on global business, innovative companies, technology trends, and exclusive behind-the-scenes videos and interviews. Start your free Bloomberg Business Week Plus subscription on your Samsung device today.
Gunderman Group.
Gunderman Group is growing.
Getting in a groove.
Growth is gratifying.
The goal is to grow.
Gotta get greater growth.
I just talked to UPS. They've got expert advice, special discounts, new technologies, like smart pickups.
They'll only show up when you print a label, and it's automatic. We save time and money.
Time? Money?
Time and money.
Awesome.
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 I love logistics.
Some said the U.S. has lost its innovative power. We said America is lighting the way as the innovation nation. Singular insights, superior execution. That's the power of global connections. Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. Voted top global research firm 2011, 12, and 13.
What a name for a press secretary. Yes. Josh Earnest. His name literally means just kidding, but seriously.
All right, our guest tonight doesn't typically answer reporters' questions in the seated and full upright position, but this evening he's making an exception. Josh Earnest, welcome.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Nice to come stop by while you're
this
in New York.
This set looks lovely. Congrats on the new show.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for seeing us.
Yeah.
Josh, the biggest piece of news of the day, we'll talk about some news stuff right now, just at the top. Biggest thing that's on the minds of a lot of Americans is Ebola, obviously. I'm curious about inside the White House whether you guys have taken any kind of special precautions in terms of White House staff to try to protect the president, to make sure that Ebola, to the extent that it is present in America, doesn't make its way inside the compound there.
Yeah. Oh, we haven't, John. And the reason for that is that, you know, we know very clearly how people get Ebola. It's a little graphic, but the fact is the only way you can catch Ebola is to come into direct contact with the bodily fluids of somebody who is showing symptoms of Ebola. So as long as you're not in contact with somebody who has Ebola, then you're not going to get it. That's reassuring to people all across the country, and it's why special precautions are not necessary in the White House or anywhere else, really.
But a lot of people do make their way through the doors of the White House on any given day.
They do. Right? They do.
So is there no screening that's necessary? I mean, again, you guys are a pretty secure compound.
Yeah, well, there's obviously lots of screening in place. But, you know, our transportation system has a lot of screening in place, too. So even before anyone can leave West Africa, where this Ebola outbreak has occurred, there's screening in place at the airport. support to make sure that you don't have symptoms of Ebola. We've trained our professionals in the transportation system, flight crews and other people, to spot people with symptoms of Ebola. You know, we had this incident in Newark over the weekend where the flight crew thought they had identified somebody who might be symptomatic for Ebola. They tested the individual and it turned out they didn't have it, but that's an indication that the flight crews are doing what they're supposed to do, which is be on the lookout for it. Right. And then there's screening here in the United States once people arrive too. So there's a multi-layered screening process in place to protect the American public and the traveling public, and people can be confident in it.
You're up here raising money with the president for the midterms. I'd go through his quick sequence. Last week, the president said that his policies were on the ballot for the midterms.
Mm-hmm, he did.
David Axelrod said there was a terrible mistake. Yeah. You said at the White House briefing yesterday, no, the president said what he meant. Yeah. Why, if the president didn't say anything wrong, is every Democratic Senate campaign we've talked to furious at what the president said?
Well, look, the point that the president was making was really clear, and it was two things. One is, he's not...
I'm going to stop you. I know, but I just want to know, you know full well that all the Senate campaigns are mad. You've probably got calls from your friends who are working on it.
No, I haven't gotten any calls from anybody.
You are not aware of the fact that every Senate campaign, every campaign with a Democrat in a contested race is furious at what he said. Is that a fact known to you or not?
It has not been communicated to me directly by anybody who works at a campaign, but let me just say this.
Oh, wait, how about indirectly? You know that that's true. I know you think the president did a mistake, and I get your logical point that you want to run on policies that are very popular. Your pollster will tell you a lot of the policies the president's advocating 70% plus popularity. But it is the case that what he said made the Democratic Senate campaigns mad. So I'm wondering, is the president going to keep saying that line? If it wasn't a mistake, will he be part of his stump speech all fall?
Well, look, the president is in no way going to back away from the fact that there is a clear choice in this election between a bunch of candidates, almost all of them on the Democratic side, who are supportive of policies that will benefit the middle class.
I'm going for yes or no.
And on the Republican side.
Yes or no. Is he going to keep repeating the line, since it wasn't a mistake? Will he keep saying, every stump speech, my policies are on the ballot?
Well, look.
That's just yes or no. Will he keep...
Yes, the president will. The president's speeches haven't been written for the fall yet. But yes, I'm confident that this is a case that the president's going to
continue
to make.
I'll bet you $100 he never says the line again.
We'll see.
Okay.
We'll see. I'm confident that this is a case the president's going to continue to make.
Okay, so you guys for the last couple of days have been dealing with Leon Panetta, who's come out with this book, has made some various criticisms. He's now doing media, saying other things that are kind of critical of the president, right?
I have noticed that, too.
And you have had those questions asked to you, you've answered them, whatever. Yeah. You know, we know, on the basis of our experience, that we as book authors, that you guys take books pretty seriously. You guys sit around and figure out in advance, what's our strategy to deal with this book as a communications matter? Mm-hmm. So what was the strategy going in before you knew Panetta had submitted his book, so you knew what was in it? What was the strategy for dealing with it, and have you guys executed it well?
Yeah, I will say I'm not sure that the White House had access to the book. I certainly didn't have access to the book before it was published. And that's different than the process that you and other authors have undertaken, who have gone in to thoroughly report these books and spend some time talking to individuals who are involved in these decisions. Now, what Secretary Panetta is doing is he's communicating his own experience. And ultimately, anybody who serves in a senior position in any administration has to make a decision for themselves about how and whether and when it's appropriate to talk about their experience. And obviously, Secretary Panetta has made that decision for himself. But, you know, the fact is the president is proud of the kinds of decisions that he made while Secretary Panetta was the Secretary of Defense.
All right.
It's made the country safer.
You're a new father, right?
I am.
And you've got a beautiful son named Walker.
Yes, that's correct.
We've done some reporting, and I got a question for you.
Okay.
Which of the following Walkers was your son named after? Was it Scott Walker, George Walker Bush, Walker Texas Ranger, or was it Jimmy J.J. Dynamite Walker? Which one?
I see.
Got to be one of those four.
It's quite quite a legacy of Walkers that he's inheriting.
Yeah.
We actually did not name him after anybody. It was a name that we came up with on our own that we liked. It actually did end up on... we did look at some family trees before we named him, and Walker is actually a name on my wife's family tree.
The Jimmy J.J. Walker Dynamite side? not necessarily.
It's a distant cousin.
Distant cousin.
Okay, I'm going to ask you two sets of questions here before we get to the end, all right? The first is about your job as dealing with reporters. I want to get these lightning round here, okay?
Okay.
Who's the most consistently delightful reporter in the White House press corps that you deal with?
That would tarnish the reputation forever for me to identify that person.
Oh, God, just more waffling. Come on.
No, I'm not waffling. I'm going to choose somebody that I don't like so I don't harm them.
Okay.
John Carl is consistently the nicest, friendliest, most direct guy, down to earth, friendliest individual that you'd ever want to meet.
I'm curious about whether Jay Carney gave you any kind of advice on how to subdue Jonathan Carl. Would you have any judo moves that you were given for him?
No physical contact has been required so far.
Okay. All right. So let's get to the last thing, the most important thing, talking about the Kansas City Royals.
Yes.
You are from...
I could do the whole show on the Royals, by the way.
Well, we're going to do the rest of the show on the Royals right
Excellent.
Now.
Excellent.
Okay. So the last time that you were Kansas City Royals... Are you from Kansas City itself?
I was born and raised.
Born and raised in Kansas City. Okay. So...
Last time the Kansas City Royals made it to the playoffs and went on to win the World Series, 1985.
Yeah.
We have this graph. We have this great picture.
Color photography had not yet been invented.
How old were you in 1985?
I was 10 years old.
Yeah, I was going to say, right. 10 years old. So you know this team.
I do.
Okay, I'd like you to name the infield of the 1985 Kansas City Royals and point them out up there. Just pick the row and how far over if you can.
Okay, well, I'm going to go in order by names I recognize. So in the front row, four over from the right is Frank White.
Okay.
Yes, second baseman.
A legend. Second baseman from Kansas City. Yeah. He's actually from Kansas City also.
Fantastic. Hometown boy made good.
That's
along
right.
With Josh Earnest.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, who
so
else?
To his right is George Brett, who's the third baseman on that team.
Yeah, easiest one to pick in the whole list.
Easiest one to pick in the whole list.
Pro pine tar or anti pine tar?
Totally pro pine tar.
Okay, great.
The more pine tar, the better.
Okay, great.
I wonder if I could use pine tar in the briefing.
Yes, you could.
On Jonathan Carr.
Exactly. Okay, exactly. Steve Balboni was the first baseman, and I don't see him in the picture, but he's a pretty recognizable individual, if you remember Steve Balboni.
And now you're looking for Onyx Concepcion. I'm sure of that.
Onyx Concepcion and Buddy Biancalana. They had a platoon there in the infield. I don't see Buddy either.
Not pictured here.
Not pictured here.
We'll look for him during
the break. That's very impressive.
And then Daryl Motley was the right fielder.
Quick prediction of the series. I know you think the Royals are going to win. How many games will it take?
I think they're going to win in six.
Royals
and they're going to clinch at Camden Yards game six.
Okay. Josh Earnest, White House Press Secretary. Thanks, man. You're nice to come in.
Thank you, fellas. Appreciate it. Enjoyed it.
Up next, we had a speech that occurred that we couldn't possibly ignore. And we're going to show it to you on another video screen when we get back.
Bloomberg's With All Due Respect is brought to you by BP, proud to be America's largest energy investor.
When folks think about what they get from Alaska, they think salmon and energy. But the energy BP produces up here creates something else as well. Jobs all over America. Engineering and innovation jobs, advanced safety systems and technology, shipping and manufacturing. Across the United States, BP supports more than 250,000 jobs. When we set up operation in one part of the country, people in other parts go to work. That's not a coincidence. It's one more part of our commitment to America.
Introducing the new and improved Bloomberg app for your iPhone and iPad. Financial markets change even when you're away from your desk. Bloomberg gives you a snapshot of what's moving, plus breaking news, video, and sophisticated portfolio management tools. Download the free Bloomberg application and stay ahead wherever you are. Also available on Android, BlackBerry, and Windows Phone.
The challenges that industry or enterprise faces the most is the consumerization of IT. Companies are having to increasingly be aware of their employee base, consuming of mobile technology and capability, and bringing that into the business and trying to leverage it in their daily work. Security is even more important in the consumerization of IT. Samsung has addressed this by bringing in a security framework to help the enterprise actually get the balance of both. Samsung's doing a lot to help our businesses meet those changes and those challenges. I believe we're the right solution for them. Samsung is committed to a holistic approach in meeting the needs of our enterprise customers in the areas of security, software, solutions, and support.
Realize the full potential of mobility. Find out more at Bloomberg.com/ad/mobile next.
As we were just discussing, Bill Clinton is back in the Razorback state, his home state, and there's so much good material that he produced while he was down there that there's literally not enough room in this show to go over all of it. But there's time to go over some of it, and it really was quite fantastic. So we're going to talk for a few minutes now about Clinton's speech today in Fayetteville, Arkansas, in this edition of Political Science Theater.
Now, here's what I want to say. The people that paid for those ads,
finger.
They will not give a rip about you the day
Arkansas
after the
before.
Election.
Yes. Look at
they are trying
the simultaneous
to create an environment in this state
of Pryor and Ross.
Resentment. Vote for what you're against.
Fantastic.
They see the surveys
like the
president and administration are not popular.
Uses
they
them
say
as
you got one more chance to cast a protest, baby. Put it in there. It's a pretty good scam.
Tools of the
scam. He's doing this thing he did yesterday. We talked about how Republicans are scamming
the six-year job
voters of Arkansas
to cast
by
the protest that will
protest
be invalid in 2 years because the president's just got 2 more years to serve.
Right.
And his opponent wants you to give him a 4-year job to cast a 2-year protest and a job that doesn't have much to do with what goes on in Washington, D.C. The
thing about Clinton is everybody thinks he's a great improviser, and he is a great improviser, but he also hones these speeches. He spends so much time working them and reworking them and taking a line when it works and figuring out what's better about it and then making it better the next day and better the next day and better the next day. He's like a great editor in addition to being a great spontaneous orator.
Blog sites the other day.
I love these kids in the back who have literally never seen anything like this.
No.
And it was highlighted. Bubba goes back to the briar patch.
Ooh. Ross gets the photo.
Clinton's Arkansas obsession. Well, I am obsessed.
I like it when he reads the internet, too.
He didn't read the internet. Somebody printed it for him. Yesterday, he said the story was on Real Clear Politics. Today, it was on the Daily Beast.
It's all the same to him.
Coming here to Fayetteville. More than four decades ago, I never would have become governor. I never would have become president.
So much off Arkansas nostalgia on this trip. Heartfelt and also incredibly effective.
A couple of my old friends, just three people, just to hear their voices up here. I am obsessed. But I did not come back to the briar patch. I came back to the future.
And that's just working the reverse anti-rural prejudice thing there. It's kind of like, you know, don't call us bumpkins,
you city slickers.
You're running the scam against us.
The ones that show them behind, they're all right. Doesn't make sense? Oh, yes, it does.
Oh, yes,
anybody can do a poll now. We could poll everybody in this crowd.
Love this one.
Because God knows Bill Clinton never loved polls when he was in office.
The question is, does this crowd reflect who's going to vote on election day? The polls that show us in trouble uniformly believe that younger voters who vote for president will not show up in a midterm.
He's been with younger voters like the last couple cycles and how Democrats can get them to turn out.
Political paralysis because an unrepresentative group of Americans vote.
Most of these events he's done while he's been on college campuses.
You got more at stake in this election. Then people like me, I have more yesterdays than tomorrows. You've got more
yesterdays
tomorrows
and tomorrow's than yesterdays,
and you better
words.
Show up
classic
and protect
line.
You tomorrow.
Awesome. All right, so a couple of days down there campaigning, we started talking about whether this is going to have a big impact on the race. What do you think?
I think it's going to have a significant impact, and by significant, I don't mean big, but in a race that close, a couple of points, which is what the people who have him down there hope that he could deliver, could be a big thing for Pryor, and that's why he's going to come back again before Election Day.
All right, you can watch all of that Bill Clinton speech from today in Fayetteville, Arkansas, on BloombergPolitics.com, and we'll be right back.
Bloomberg's With All Due Respect is brought to you by Mercedes-Benz, engineering some of the most advanced vehicles on the road today.
Decay. It's the opposite of evolution. The absence of improvement and the enemy of perfection, which is why you can never stop moving forward, never stop inventing. Introducing the Mercedes-Benz GLA, a breakthrough in design, aerodynamics, and engineering, because the only way to triumph over decay is to leave it in its own dust.
Only Bloomberg Television has the interviews you want to hear.
One of the fascinating things about Twitter is that once you get it, it becomes indispensable to you.
My eyes were all created equal.
Online, on your tablet, and on your phone. Bloomberg Television, wherever you are.
I think that the Malaysian government creates a very business-friendly environment. They've been working alongside us throughout the 40 over years. We wouldn't be where we are today without that support. And obviously, that support would continue.
Malaysia is at the forefront of success. We have very talented people, world-class infrastructure, and we provide a very strategic environment for businesses to grow.
Ours was the first modern airliner, revolutionary by every standard. And that became our passion, to always build something better. Airplanes that fly cleaner and farther on less fuel, that redefine comfort and connect the world like never before. After all, you can't turn dreams into airplanes unless your passion for innovation is nonstop.
A quick correction from earlier. The American League Championship Series starts on Friday night at Camden Yards. We are live 24/7 on BloombergPolitics.com.
Taking stock is next.
Partnerships occur
When both share a passion for improving, for growing in harmony. Speak from the heart and respect the other. Feeling of being comfortable, of being open, that creates the true partnership, which ensures that